living in those rural areas would respect the state as the state and see it as legitimate when it can't even show up. It doesn't, and you know, they might, the state itself might actually meet the other criteria, right? They might have good intentions. They might want to do those things, but if they don't have the capacity to do them, then what are they? And before we go on any further, I just want to remind everybody that this is the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Hale, your host for today. And with me is Aaron and Brandon, and we're talking about legitimate and illegitimate states. So thanks for listening, and we'll continue on.
Just for the sake of clarity, are we on the second criteria or the third criteria?
So we're on the criteria of states must be able to provide on some level for their citizens.
Okay.
So another way of saying it is states must be able to actually show up and be involved. Mm-hmm. In
so that's your third criteria, right?
Yeah.
And the second was, just to, for the sake of reminder?
Yeah. The second one was, so the first one I'll say is states must be made up of citizens and have clearly defined boundaries. The second one was the primary aim of a state must be the good of its citizens.
Okay. And that's distinct from the third, which is that the government has to show up.
Yeah. So basically the government has to be able to, like, so a state can have the aim of providing for its citizens, of providing the good, but if it doesn't actually have the tools and capacity to show up, you know, like, let's take it a really extreme example.
So a state must have not only the desire to do good for its people, but also the ability.
The capacity on some level, right? Like, obviously, these aren't clearly defined boundaries, right? But like when you look, like going back again, there are certain countries currently in the world even where like the state literally does not have that capacity, right? And so, you know, that puts itself in a very difficult situation, both for the state itself and also for its, you know, the citizens that it purports to be, you know, taking care of or a part of.
It would be a totally different show. But I think a very related concept here is what should a state's what is the relationship between a state and acts of violence? What types of acts of violence are ethically justified, or I should rephrase that to, with a state in mind, what types of acts of violence are necessary, usually to maintain itself, or those that are strictly for self-defense. Are generally speaking the guidelines that some people have used. What I was looking at briefly here is in Thomas More's book Utopia, it's stated that the utopians hate war and try to avoid it at all costs. They find no glory in harming other people, but they constantly train and, if pressed, prove a mighty enemy. They engage in warfare only to protect themselves, their friends, or to free oppressed people. And that's, you know, it's from a very old book, but you can definitely see that idea still would carry water in the Western tradition, that we would see a state having a right to protect itself, protect its allies, or to intervene on behalf of oppressed peoples. Thomas More's account and the Western account there has been criticized, especially because that exact justifications were what were used in expansionist, imperialist, and colonial rule. So that view has been heavily critiqued in that regard. Having the ability to defend oneself, defend one's own borders, and defend one's own nation, it's a pretty central idea to Western canon when it comes to what is legitimate state.
Thanks, Aaron. Should we move on to the fourth one that I have, which is something that you already hinted at, Brandon, and I'll read it off now. I wrote, states must recognize and have a reasonable degree of respect for other states. This gets super thorny. It's really, you know, it's not a clear line. It kind of comes down in my mind to not entering a self-destructive principle, right? That, you know, states must sort of view themselves on some level as equals or similar participants in similarly aligned projects. If you have a state that is, and there have been states, obviously, that we've been already talked about, that take the opposite line, that basically as their specific state, they have the right to take over other states. Well, really that invites other states to do the same thing. You know, if everybody, if you have the right, if on an individual level, if I have the right to go around murdering people, well, then it would seem that other people have the right to murder me. And so it seems that without this principle, there's some degree of mutually assured self-destruction that would go on. And so these states kind of need this sense of respect. The thing that comes up obviously with this one for me is, okay, well, what about war, and when is war legitimate? Is war ever legitimate? Like you were mentioning with Thomas More's Utopia, right? Like, are there ever times, you know, the best states obviously don't want to engage in war, but are there times when they have to? Are there times when they should? It seems like we are moving past an era where territorial expansion, for territorial expansion's sake, essentially, is no longer respected. Obviously, it's still done. You know, we're currently living, it's 2023. You know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is recent and ongoing. But outside of a few, like, very closely aligned Russian allies and effectively puppet states, most states within the international community don't look upon Russia's actions as being legitimate in any kind of way. And I think that hints at the fact that that sort of old school, and you mentioned it too, like it, the old school imperial era of, well, bigger states can take over smaller states because effectively they can, and they have a right to expand and protect their borders and et cetera, right? And colonize and however, whatever it might be. We're kind of walking away from that. And like ultimately, that's also the kind of link thinking that led to First and Second World War, right? It's not like it's clearly not a healthy and effective line long term, because you know, all this, virtually all the states except for the United States, but all the main players, and even that's, I guess, arguable, but even within the Second World War, suffered incredible degrees of destruction due to that. That is exactly that kind of mindset, right? They were essentially decimated, especially in Europe and East Asia. So, you know, obviously I threw that criteria in there because, you know, unless everybody wants to blow each other up, you know, like what's the point of having a state operating if it can't, you know, get along or at least respect and understand its neighbors to be a similar type of entity?
Yeah. One of the oldest disciplines in historical studies, or I should say areas of historical study, is diplomatic history. Especially with regards to in the Western tradition and European history. Prior to the treaties that were signed in Vienna after the Napoleonic Wars, it was quite often for there to be what were called great power conflicts between nations of Europe. And after those treaties were signed, after the Napoleonic Wars, essentially there were no great power conflicts. There were still wars, but there were no great power conflicts. So there was a relative long period of peace, basically just under 100 years. And then there was and then of course that ended with the First World War, which essentially was when the nations of Europe all got involved in conflict because they had these long-lasting treaties going all of the way back to the Treaty of Vienna, although they had been added to since. So essentially, taking Thomas More's example of a nation should avoid war at all costs except for self-defense, defending its allies and intervening for oppressed peoples. The notion of going to defense of one's allies was essentially the cause of the First World War, because everyone had these very complicated treaties of, if this person attacks my ally, then I must defend them, and then this person must defend my ally, and then I must defend them. And so that relationship created, or I guess you could say, because those treaties were essentially written in stone, that created an international environment which led to the First World War. So that's all, of course, a bit of an oversimplification. It leads into the problems of how we properly negotiate that fourth criteria and whether or not it should be something that's set up by permanent agreements or something that should be an ongoing relationship. In the modern day, it seems that countries value ongoing relationships much more than long-standing agreements, and that may or may not be a good thing. although there are still some international agreements that have been held for a long time.
Yeah, and that's actually, you know, I'm really glad you brought that up. I've actually been reading another book recently called The Ring of Steel, which is a pretty expansive study of central powers during the First World War. You know, thinking about some of our previous criteria, like especially, you know, the primary aim of a state must be, you know, the good of its citizens. The two main states in the First World War, talking about like this kind of domino effect specifically, the Habsburg Empire and Serbia, were both operating under very malicious grounds, for lack of a better way of saying it. Serbia effectively supporting terrorist organizations within the Habsburg Empire, and Habsburg Empire effectively putting all its guns and mechanisms towards destroying Serbia as a state. Now, because of the alliances, the concrete agreements that went on, obviously, you know, those states, particularly the first two ones to really jump into this domino effect, the Russian Empire and the German Empire, Russian Empire for the Serbs, German Empire for the Habsburgs, who are the Habsburgs, as it should be said, there's the famous, the 10 demands or 12 demands or whatever the Habsburgs made on the Serbs. Anyways, the Habsburgs purposefully made demands of the Serbs that they knew they would reject, because they wanted them to reject it, because they wanted to start a war. But, and then on the Russian side, there was some other kind of similar stuff going on. But basically, what I'm saying is you have these concrete agreements that sort of override any sort of parsing out of the legitimacy of the actions of a particular state, right? And basically saying, like, are you acting legitimately right now, right? Like, are you effectively, what you're saying, what you're doing right? We have a more modern example of this, I think, which is the Afghanistan and the Iraq war with the United States, where you're talking about ongoing relationships. And these ongoing relationships are more, I think, fluid, effectively, right? They're like ongoing friendships where, you know, the different partners essentially suss each other out depending upon their actions in any given moment. So within the context of the invasion of Afghanistan, when you look as awry as it eventually went, the initial invasion, which had broad support from the international community, was based around the fact that, in fact, Al-Qaeda, after, you know, committing the acts of 9/11 and stuff like that, were based out of Afghanistan and, you know, run by the Taliban, and the Taliban would not hand them over. They would not give them up. You know, there's some debate about how much of a negotiation the United States was really willing to have. But, you know, the United States effectively went to the Taliban and said, give us Osama bin Laden, give us Al-Qaeda, or else we're coming to get them. And the Taliban basically said, well, then come get them. And the international community was behind the United States, generally speaking, in that action, right? All things considered. A few years later, roughly 2 years later, the United States has very, 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 very poor grounds for invading Iraq. And most of the international community, including Canada, refuses to join on that, despite the longstanding relationship. Because I think most states at that time recognized that the actions that were being undertaken by the United States and by the current administration were not legitimate. They were not happening for understandable, correct reasons, whatever they were. And the information and the basically narrative that was being pushed was incredibly thin and duplicitous, and many states, not all, but most of the, you know, very core American aligned states within the world refused to participate. Unlike in Afghanistan, where far, far more countries joined the international coalition that was involved in that initial invasion. So I think that's an example of how different states actually, how that, you know, this kind of principle is being more enacted in terms of current state relationships. Should we move on to the last one? It's kind of my favorite, actually. I think it's the most interesting. I find it's simply, I wrote, states must respect themselves. So what does that mean? States must respect themselves. So let's go back to our paradigm case we were talking about earlier, the Third Reich. And, you know, the Nazi Party, and obviously Hitler and his, you know, group of effectively cronies and all that kind of stuff. I put this in there because the Third Reich is a really interesting example of a state that actively deconstructed and did not respect its own institutions. States need to be reliable. States are made up of bureaucracies, judiciaries, civil service, militaries, whatever it might be, those services that provide energy. Particularly the judiciary is important, parliament, judiciary, government functions, lawmaking within the context of this. Sometimes people don't realize that when the Nazis took power in 1933, they didn't actually formally deconstruct the state much through most of their reign. The general bureaucratic structure and legal code of the Third Reich, on paper, remained pretty similar to the Weimar Republic. There were slight changes here or there, and I say slight. They were not slight for some people. But generally speaking, those institutions on paper still existed. However, in practice, they were completely ignored. They were oftentimes considered completely irrelevant. What really mattered, and this is oftentimes called, historians often refer to this as the dual state, that there was the official, state, German state, but really what mattered was the Nazi Party and primarily the rule and decrees of Hitler and his immediate underlings, and what they say went. But they would not actually change through the legal processes and through parliamentary governmental bureaucratic processes, laws and decrees and that sort of thing. They would basically just operate like a gang within a state. So let's actually talk about there's two great examples of this that I can think of right now. The first is the Enabling Act in 1934, which was basically the act that gave Hitler dictatorial powers. Germany had a two-thirds vote system within the Reichstag, its parliament, and to get such a change to the constitution enacted, which is what they needed to initially do. And the way that they did this, because they didn't actually have enough votes, was they just deleted a bunch of the seats in the Reichstag. So basically, there's 240 seats. We don't have enough. Well, just, we're going to just say there's 200 now because screw it. Like, there's 200 seats now. So that's an example of, like, the persons and functionaries within a state completely disregarding the actual state structures. Another one that was completely pervasive, I can actually think of another one after this, but another one that was completely pervasive, which has to do with the judiciary, and particularly in the penal system, was throughout its history, the Third Reich had a relatively functioning penal system. Obviously, some of the laws and, the punishments changed, much to the loss of the individuals who had to go through that system. But generally speaking, it was a pretty standard Western judiciary of the time. So you would be, let's say you committed a crime. Let's say it was a relatively normal crime. We would consider something normal, like theft. If you committed theft, you would be sentenced to X number of years for, a break-in or whatever it might be. People rely upon the judiciary being effectively a reliable system that they can understand and predict. Well, what would happen for most of the individual, or a large portion of the individuals who would go through that judiciary, is when they were released from prison, there would be members of the Gestapo, of the SS, of whoever, functionaries of the Nazi Party, waiting at the gates of the prison to take them to a concentration camp to continue their incarceration indefinitely till whenever they felt like releasing them, right? There would be no timetable given or anything like that. It's just like, we're going to take you because we want to, and that's it. So that's completely undermining the judicial system, the penal system, all that, and completely not respecting the state itself. Another example I'll give, there are so many of these, understandably, because this is the paradigm case, but one more is backdating decrees. This is something that's not legitimate at all. Nobody respects doing this. Basically, making something illegal on a certain date and then just effectively lying and saying that you made it actually illegal like 4 years ago so that you can arrest people who committed those crimes prior to you enacting this new decree. Again, this is something that happened quite regularly it completely undermines the legitimacy and the reliability of decrees and laws and the judicial system. And this stuff was very common within the Third Reich. And so that's what I mean. And you can go on and on about that, but those are just examples of what I mean by states not respecting themselves. Having a bureaucracy, having a system in place that is on the face of it there, but serves no other function than to effectively just be a kind of veil for the whims of some sort of other political entity operating in the background.
The kind of official term for this type of respect for oneself that you're talking about for a state is kind of the Western concept of rule of law, which is that no citizen is above the law, whether they be an average citizen or the ruler of the country, so that everyone is subject to the laws and no one can change the laws except by proper course. I did want to read a quote by Martin Niemöller. I think I mispronounced that, but he was a German pastor, and I think this is something that most people run into in high school English usually, but it's, first they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and then there was no one left to speak for me. And that kind of reiterates how in Germany at that time, what the state was doing was taking away the rights of its citizens, kind of group by group, until the only citizens who had rights were those that they wanted to have rights and supported the government. And by that point, can you even call them rights? Because they don't extend to everyone. They don't have that rule of law.
Especially when states don't have a rule of, effectively don't have a rule of law, or have a rule of law that's completely arbitrary, there's no place for rights to exist. And you enter a state that is effectively totalitarian and is, often also termed as like a terror regime, and there are other great examples of this, even from the same period. You think about stuff like the Soviet Union, particularly under Stalin, under the Soviet terror period in the late 1930s, where it was kind of just on a whim, whoever would be arrested, oftentimes executed, whatever. The denunciations were just a formality. And it almost became, it becomes such an apparatus of the state to effectively destroy itself, that there is no logic in it. And that's actually how, as people, theorists such as Hannah Arendt have pointed out, and others as well, that's actually how terror functions. The unpredictability of terror makes it a far more effective weapon than terror that can be understood and predicted, because you never know when it's coming for you. But it's also not a state. Like, it doesn't function like a reliable bureaucracy, right? It's the complete opposite of that. Timothy Snyder, a modern historian, particularly of the Third Reich and Soviet Union through this period, states that, made a really interesting quote that I think is so on point, which is, he effectively says, the standard operation of states is that they have a monopoly on violence. The Third Reich did not have a monopoly on violence. What they did was set out to unleash and targeted anarchy. And that was the main operation of that political entity, whatever it was not to monopolize violence in their hand, but was to unleash a kind of terror, both within their own state, but particularly abroad, that didn't have a sensical structure to it, like we expect from reasonable, reliable states that meet the other criteria that we've gone through so far and respect themselves as well. Because everyone within the context of that state is a legitimate target in some way or another.
It seems like with the second criteria of having the citizen or being for the citizens good, it seems like this one might overlap with this, but I'm seeing that it's actually quite distinct. There's a difference between having your citizens' interests in mind, being a state. A state could, start kind of, I'm thinking of the idiom, hitting the ground running. Well, opposite of that, a state could take a while to get itself functioning, or it might not, it might need some assistance. That doesn't make it illegitimate if it gets there at some point. I think the third criteria, if it continuously failed to do that, it would need to be legitimized and through making an effective state. But this seems to be different. This seems to be, well, you could have a state that has some of its citizens in mind and kind of puts on a show that, oh, this is in the interest of, you know, this class or the state itself. This is in the interest of the state, but it's completely illegitimate. It's just it's a clown show. The state has lost all respectability. The kind of, I don't want to say the facade of the state, but the legitimacy of the state falls, even with some acts that seem like they might be in the state's interests or the state's citizens' interest.
You know what? There's so much more to be said on this topic, but I am conscious of the time. So I want to thank both of you for the wonderful discussion, Aaron and Brandon. And I've been your host tonight, everybody, for the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Hale. We hope you'll join us next time. Thank you.
Archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.